On Tuesday, March 8th, 2016, we have all members present, full quorum. We have only one item on today's schedule, and that's Senate Bill 91, which may not necessarily, but we have a safety meeting in the afternoon in case we don't finish everything here. We did not close public testimony previously. We're going to take the public testimony first. I'd like to invite Ms. Haynes to come forward if she still wishes. Welcome.
I oppose this bill.
And just a little closer to the microphone. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Emily Haynes.
Take your time.
I'm a little nervous. I oppose this bill. It's going to have a direct impact on my life. 5 years ago, I was a victim of a violent sexual assault, and the offender will be eligible for release immediately under your proposal. For the past 5 years, I've been fighting this case. I have been very active in trying to get him convicted. Multiple grand juries, a full trial in which I was questioned for a day and a half, and finally reached a resolution that I was happy with. And now to find out that you guys are wanting him to be released after serving a quarter of a sentence is pretty hurtful. This is going to happen to a lot of victims across the state. While you guys say it's not going to be retroactive, that's still not going to make an effect on my case. But think of all the victims in the future that are likely not going to even want to go forward with trying to convict someone of something that they've done to them. Because, I don't know if a year and a half ago I would have even wanted to continue, if I wanted to go to a full trial, knowing that this guy would just be let go. Obviously I had a game plan before I came up here, and now I don't really know what to say. I think that I've been one of the more proactive victims, working with prosecutors constantly. For the entirety of 5 years, I don't know if you guys understand how that's every few months checking in, every few months going over everything. Having trials get delayed, having to redo things, and it's one of the securities that I've had also is that this guy has been in jail the whole time. It's nice to not have to worry about running into this person on the streets or anywhere. There's one of the proposals in your bill is to not have the ability to allow the inability to pay to be one of the things that the judge can use to determine what to set the bail at. And initially, this guy had may have been able to, and then he was linked to another case. That victim chose not to continue on, and so this will be the only conviction. He will be completely eligible for every single thing that you guys have proposed, even though this is an obviously dangerous person. There's no other convictions. This will be the first one. He will be convicted under a plea deal. and that is something that I'm happy with. However, I know that while instead of facing four felonies, he will only get charged with one. But that makes, I'm okay with that. And I don't know where I am right now. With that, though, there are many instances where plea deals, I know that, you know, one of the arguments is that you guys don't want the Department of Law to continue offering plea deals to all these people, but sometimes that's the best option. Sometimes I don't want to go through a whole another trial. I don't want to have to go do that again and maybe let this guy get off. So with the plea deal, again, though, it's taking him from serving another 5 years in serving to letting him out immediately. I mean, after a quarter of the time, it's just an insane. I don't know how you can justify that. And then once he is let out, I completely oppose the idea that you can have just one standard consequence for probation violation for every single offender. He can find me, and he will go to jail for 3 days, maximum. That's it. I don't. Instead of allowing a judge to determine whether or not that violation is worthy of, I would assume, more of a sentence, to equate that to maybe one of his violations is he can't have alcohol. I mean, I don't know how you can take both of those examples and say that those are completely equal. That, again, it just makes it, I just don't understand. And I don't think a lot of victims realize that this is something that is being proposed right now. I didn't know about it until I found out that he was going to accept a plea deal. That's 2 weeks ago. And in 2 weeks, he'll accept that, and he won't be sentenced until after this bill is in effect. I understand that you guys want to, implement some sort of prison reform, but I just don't think that, I don't know if you're not aware, I mean, I assume you are smart people, but the amount of people that this is going to affect is incredible. I don't think that violent offenders, I mean, and this guy, he has no record of any sort of previous assault. So do you guys have, I don't know what sort of risk assessment you're going to use, but there's no way, I don't see him not being eligible for an early release, even though this is a horrible person. This is not someone that should be let out of jail. I think that nonviolent offenders, as long as you haven't hurt someone, I don't know why. I just don't know how you can say that both violent and nonviolent offenders should be treated the same. I guess there's so many aspects to this bill. I'll probably have to write something up and submit it as well.
And Ms. Haynes, this is going to be going through a couple more committees, and three of the members are on the committee. I appreciate the amount of time the term courage has been thrown around a little bit too loosely in describing people that have testified. I think you epitomize it, and I know this is not an easy thing for you to do today, so thank you. Thank you for coming forward.
Thanks.
And continue. I won't be in any other committees, but continue to work with a sponsor, and I will, and I, as you've probably heard, I'm not one of the cheerleaders of the bill. I'm not going to, obviously, I'm in a little more neutral position here as chairman right now, but I think I'm a little more on your side than you think. So I appreciate you coming forward and continue to work with the Office of Victims' Rights, and I hope this will encourage other people to look at the victims aspect of the bill as well. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghlan.
I might just thank her. First of all, I think it does take a lot of courage, and I'm sorry for the issues, but I think there's some fundamental misunderstandings of what this bill is doing that I'd be glad to have her come and look through the bill on, because whether it's the difference between a violent and a nonviolent crime, sexual assault crime, there's some issues in here that I think there's some fundamental misunderstandings, so I'd be glad to visit with her.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Mr. Morgan. Can you please take your hat off? I'm not Paul Seaton here. Please identify yourself.
My name is Don Morgan. I live here in Juneau. I own a business downtown, the Hashagoon Native Art Gallery. I started that 2 years ago. I started it a week after I got out of prison. I had served 38 and a half years. And I support the majority of this crime bill. I agree that I think rape is a violent crime, and it shouldn't be minimized. I am one of those who probably slipped through the cracks that didn't receive any help when I got out. I pretty much did everything on my own, just working hard, owning a business, working a regular job too. So a person can do it. But I also, while I was in prison, I helped start was on the planning and organizing committee to start the faith-based program in there. Even though I wasn't a Christian, I believed it was a positive program that would help people, and it has helped a lot of people in there. I pretty much kept to myself and saved all my money for the one chance I would have to get out to do what I wanted to do. I stayed involved in positive things, programs, whatever I could. But on the other hand, being out and owning a business and being a victim of petty crimes and some of the stuff going on in this town, I can see both sides. You know, I attend meetings by the Downtown Improvement Group since it started, trying to affect some kind of change in this town with the homeless and drunks and everything going on downtown here. For the most part, I support this bill. I understand the victim's point of view. I think victims have a voice at a parole board. I know when I went for parole, the police department, the district attorney, the victim's family were all contacted to ask if they had anything to say. So they do have a voice, and if they have serious feelings, I think, like the woman who just testified, anybody who's been a victim like that, that person should not be paroled to the same location as their victim, for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan, and appreciate hearing the success story, even though it took a while.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming up today. Kate Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kate Burkhart. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. My comments today represent those boards who do support SB 91. I would like to thank the sponsor and the committee for being responsive to the testimony you've received from victims of crime. Prior to this part of my career, I was a domestic violence attorney representing victims of interpersonal violence and sexual assault and child sexual assault for several years here in Alaska. So I do understand the need to balance the rights and obligations we have to victims of serious crime and the need that we have as a state to prevent recidivism and contain our prison costs. SB 91 balances the health and safety needs of Alaskans. It does provide for protecting victims of crime and Alaskans in general from violent offenders while implementing evidence-based programs that help divert nonviolent offenders, and particularly my constituency, people disabled by behavioral health disorders who are overrepresented in the prison system, to community services that are more likely to help them achieve stability and stay out of institutions like our prison system. We've seen the success of these kinds of evidence-based programs, like the 24/7 program that Senator Coghill and others helped establish in Alaska, and we believe that the provisions in SB 91 do help further the gains we've made so far. Again, we believe that SB 91, especially with the care and consideration of this committee, balances the interests of victims of crime and the state's interests in protecting public health and safety and containing costs in the prison system. Thank you.
And your letter is on, it's in the committee record and available for the public as well. Thank you very much. Rich Moore from Anchorage, OffNet.
Good morning, Mr. Committee Chair.
Good morning.
Senator Coghill and members of the State Affairs Committee. My name is Butch Moore. I'd like to thank your committee and Senator Coghill for taking many of the suggestions and making many of the amendments that people have suggested. One of the things that this bill started out as, which we are very much in agreement to, is not incarcerating individuals and turning them into criminals for minor offenses. One of the things that's very, very important, and I think your first speaker really said it all, this bill is not intended to release violent offenders, not intended to release murderers or sexual offenders. And so I have two items. I sent a letter last night that I hope you are in receipt of. One of the things that you've done in this bill in three different areas, you have added to the bill, if the defendant has not been convicted of an unclassified felony, a sexual felony, or a crime involving domestic violence, then they are omitted from the early release and other items. One of the items that I think that same paragraph should be added to is your section 330525, which is the probation incentive reduction time compilation. It currently reads, a probation officer shall recommend to the sentencing court a probation incentive reduction for good conduct by a person on probation. I think that it's appropriate, especially based on what your first speaker stated, that we should add that same paragraph into that section so that it would say, if the defendant has not been convicted of an unclassified felony offense, a sexual felony as defined by Alaska statutes, or a crime involving domestic violence as described by Alaska statutes. And I think that will resolve part of what your first speaker spoke to. And I think that's the intention of the bill. The Pew Charitable Trust said that we should release nonviolent offenders to take the pressure off the prison system. However, we should become a little more harsh on violent and sexual offenders. The other portion of the bill, which we've had conversation with Senator Coghill about is that when my representative, Mark Newman, made the penalties, the minimum maximum penalties for rape and sexual assault, when he increased those, he actually increased those above and beyond those for murder. So when Josh Almeida murdered my daughter last June, he used a gun. His minimum time in jail that he can serve is 10 years. He can be out in 10 years. If he would have raped her and used a gun, his minimum time in jail is 25 to 35 years, if that's his first offense. So I have also in my letter a recommendation from the Office of Victims' Rights that I would like, and I'm requesting Senator Coghill to make an amendment to the bill, not just to add the prior paragraph under the good time compilation, but also if you would be able to add a minimum mandatory sentence for murder, because I think my daughter would much rather have been raped than been killed, which is why a lot of women and men are raped and not killed, because they fear for their life and they would much rather stay alive. So although the sentences imposed by judges generally are longer than 10 years for murder two or 20 years for murder one, I don't think it would be a difficult argument for your committee or the next committee to make that a minimum mandatory sentence for murder should be at least equal to that of sexual assault and rape. So I want to thank you again, because you have a lot of work to do. The Alaska Safe Children's Act, we're taking a task force with a lot of people over a year and a half, and this bill is encompassing not just Aaron's Law and Bree's Law, two items, you're encompassing hundreds of items that have literally thousands of different effects. So I really do appreciate your willingness to take all the input and consider all the effects of the bill, and I know we're trying to do this quickly, but there are some very long-lasting effects. And the decisions that you guys make and the laws that you make now will determine the release of Josh Almeida and other violent criminals such as himself. So this is a very important bill to us, and I think it's a very important bill to a lot of other people. I think your first speaker, actually, I can't say anything more. I think that really is the basis for the consideration of any of the changes that are brought to you by the different parties, whether it's the Department of Law or the Office of Victims' Rights or victims or ourselves. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Coghill.
Hang on there a second, Mr. Moore. I was going to ask Senator McGuire if she would take this issue to the next committee, just to make sure we fully vet it. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were thinking on the same track. Butch, thank you for your testimony today and all of your advocacy for Alaska's kids and turning the heartache in your family into something positive for future generations of kids in Alaska. And I just want to make a pledge to you that as the bill moves into our committee in the Senate Judiciary Committee, that we'll work on this issue. Senator Coghill and I work well together, and we'll look at the pairing between those two things. I think you made your point very well that clearly you wouldn't want to have someone be given an advantage of good time where they've taken someone's life in a place where over someone who has committed rape. And I think we'll go back and make sure that those places are paired up. And please continue to provide more testimony in email form or call the office and let me know as it moves in. We're going to work on it Wednesday and Friday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I know you've got a good advocate here in Senator McGuire as well. I know you've worked with her. So did Mrs. Moore want to testify as well, or did you speak for both of you?
I think I've spoken for both of us. One of the things that Cindy feels very strongly about, and I want to say that I think this bill has some very, very good points to it, and that we really don't want to turn people into criminals. And I think that Senator Coghill's bill has a lot of very, very good parts to it. I think there are a lot of people that go to jail that are not career criminals that basically have no other choice, because when they get out, they're a felon, they can't have a job, and a lot of the Pew Foundation's information that they put in and input that they gave was a reinvestment. And one of the things I haven't seen in the bill is an actual reinvestment plan. And I think that's very, very important, that when people get out of jail, just like the speaker before us, when people are released, it would be nice to have a plan that we could implement to help them integrate back into society and not go back to becoming a professional criminal when maybe they were not in the first place. So I think the bill has some very good intentions, and I think in the end, it can be something that's very positive.
Thanks, and that point has been brought up, and I think that's the only way it works, if there is reinvestment. Thank you very much to both you and Mrs. Moore.
Thank you.
Let's see. Mike Coons and Palmer.
Yes, Senator, in the committee. My name is Mike Coons. I'm from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. There's so much to this. My main thing when it comes down to the justice system is that the justice system, in my humble opinion, is I would say broke. I don't even know if it's fixable or not. And I think one of the things we have to really look at fixing our judicial system is kind of like, you know, Barack Hussein Obama refuses to talk about, you know, Islamic terrorists. But we call the justice system the criminal justice system. And it's not the victim justice system. It's not a justice system. It's a criminal justice system. And I think we need to, you know, look at that totality of that terminology. The other aspect to this thing that really gets me, as you hear this all the time, is about DA discretionary. You know, the DA can, you know, they got such a caseload that they have to, you know, give discretion to each one of these, and, well, can we plea bargain this down? Can we do this? Can we do that? In the first speaker, you know, she was okay with the plea bargain. And the guy should have gone to a plea bargain to begin with. You know, from what she said, it sounds like, you know, this guy, you know, put through some major cracks. So I would get a real problem with, you know, that. I don't know if that's something we can do in the bill, or can we? I just don't know. But we need to come down somehow or another. The DAs have got to understand that this is about the victims, and it's about the justice. And if a person has committed a crime, they're presumed innocent until proven guilty. True. Yes, absolutely. I want that same assurance as if I get wrongfully arrested for something. But if I have committed the crime, then I'm going to do the time. That's what I was taught. I'm 63 years old. You know, I was taught that from when I was a kid. Using closed prisons with nonprofit help, we can get people off drugs. I totally get that, and I know that they're doing that in Texas. They had like 13 prisons that they shut down. The recidivism rate is really, really low now because of it. I thought that was, I think that's really good. The aspect on violent criminals versus nonviolent is, my big concern is that, yeah, this person's going to be eligible for all these things because they got convicted or they plead out on a nonviolent. But how do we ensure that person wasn't plea bargained from a violent down to a nonviolent, because the DA just was too busy and didn't want to take it all the way up to the violent aspect? This person has a violent history, but he's been plea bargaining it down to a nonviolent all this time. You know, that's the other aspect. And lastly, Jordan Schilling, who works for Senator Coghill, and Jordan's I can't say enough good about Jordan. He's been phenomenal. He's been working with me on this whole issue of, if we want to reduce the prison population, the one easy way of doing that is when we have a felon that is now stepped across the line and has committed a federal felony, like a felon in possession of a firearm, a felon that is raping somebody with a firearm, a felon that is robbing somebody with a firearm, that is mandatory minimum 5, 10, 15, 20 to life, depending on the severity, federal prison. But then Jordan went to the department, to the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Casey Schroeder, and asked about that, and she wrote back, quote, "You have asked me why the state does not defer local law enforcement responsibility to the federal government. The short answer is that any time a federal law is violated, federal agencies may come into Alaska and investigate and prosecute that crime. However, primary law enforcement rests with the states. This notion is reflected in both the 10th Amendment and the fact that the federal criminal laws are not as developed as state criminal laws." Is not as developed? I mean, my God, just listening to the congressmen and senators in the House and Senate and Congress, I think they would probably cringe about that stop comment. Then she goes on to say there are many state crimes for which there is no corresponding federal offense. Rape isn't something that goes along with that, especially the use of the firearm in the commission of that crime. Further, in order to bring a case in federal court, there must be a federal nexus. For example, federal nexus may be found if the offense affects interstate or foreign commerce or against a federal official. I thought why in the world do we have laws? Why in the world do we have to go through all the jumping through hoops to Congress? Why are we doing all this? I mean, who's the sovereign? The states or the feds? You know, if the feds are going to sit there and just come up with a whole bunch of federal laws and nobody uses them, then we're just going to continue filling up our state prisons when they need to be going to the feds and saving us a whole bundle of money. So that one just really irks me. But I'm not a Senator Coghill. We've talked, and Jordan and I have talked, and I'm not convinced on this. I'm not adamantly against this bill, but I'm definitely not for it either. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Coons, for your usual in-depth study of the legislation. I'm sure some of your opponents here would like you to get a job, but I'm glad you've got some time to do this. Thank you very much, Mike. Roger Branson, and you're retired. I don't mean you're not working. Thanks. Mr. Branson.
Dr. Branson here. Speaking on behalf of myself, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing this opportunity for me. General support for Senate Bill 91. I think that if we could start moving some of the money that it costs us to have the people in prisons to reentry programs, that would empower them to be held accountable as individuals for their actions. Very much agree with Mr. Moore, and provide a path out at the end of figuring out what that accountability is and performing it. To me, that's a no-brainer. Again, that was my main point, and I thank the committee for the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Branson. Look forward to running into you back home soon.
Thank you.
Susan Hathaway in Fairbanks.
Yes, sir. My name is Susan Hathaway, and I'm the director of my limits here in Fairbanks, Alaska. And we have a transitional housing program and a reentry center for returning citizens, and we support the Senate Bill 91. And I personally feel reducing the number of the prison beds will free up funds to reinvest back into the community to use for the supported services. And what we do in our program is we have case management, we have employment specialists that help the felons and misdemeanors find employment, and we teach them life skills and eventually get them into their own permanent housing. And Let's see. I'm sorry. We've had a lot of personal experience with people re-entering the community and completing our program, and we just feel that we greatly support this bill and feel like it's instrumental for returning citizens to regain their status into the community. And I just want to thank the committee for Senate Bill 91. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hathaway. Let's see, we have Cassandra Hunneke in Anchorage.
Hi.
Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record and give us a couple moments of testimony.
My name is Cassandra Hunneke. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I'd like to thank you for your time, Senator Caldwell, on the committee. Previously known as Russell, OBSIS number 484169, and I am in support of the Senate Bill 91 for the programs. I'd like to go off of Ms. Hathaway. I am a continued DWI offender for several years, and as the great Robert Frost in the past less traveled, it takes that to figure out that you need to first be accountable. And the programs that are offered through Department of Corrections, EM offices, Highland Mountain especially has a wonderful program through Aquila that finally I needed to invest it in myself, graduated that, took advantage of every program available, and the programs are there. What's sad to see is out of an inmate of 450, the amount of women that take accountability and get into those programs is where I see the recidivism so high. I went through the orchestra there, every college program through UAA and the Symbolic College now, the construction trades programs, there's computer programs, treatment programs, faith-based programs, they're there. It's getting the women to be accountable for their actions to be able to take that step into those programs. Once I finally did that, 4 years later, I am now Ms. Hunneke in EM for 2 years and outpatient through Aquila graduate mentor, attend weekly meetings, have been married, now have a child, house, and still stay focused in those programs, and I'm up for discretionary parole board in April. And it takes finally getting yourself involved in doing something different. It's trying to find out how to get the population of, I don't want to say non-violent offenders, because especially in my case, a DWI can be a violent offense. I mean, it's one blink of an eye. So making sure that those programs are still available for the small amount of women and men that choose to go down that path is what I see the hang-up is. The classrooms are bare. The programs, the lists are either too long and they decide not to wait, and I know that's a problem on the outside as well. So finding more beds, more availability for programs within Department of Corrections on the outside as well. The support is there, and as far as the victims go, the best way I see in crimes such as myself has caused the community, and holding up my obligations for that is doing the next right thing. So having those programs available for the ones that choose to do that and show that they can be successful. I'm back in college now and everything. So I think my problem is finding out how to make sure there's more availability for the women that don't want to give up because they can't get into the programs, to help lessen the recidivism. Even through the Anchor Monitor office in Anchorage, the support, the counseling, the guidance, the directives as opinions and not authoritarian necessarily, but as somebody standing beside you is amazing. it's just having the availability is where I see the hang-up. But it is possible if that person wants to have it. So I don't have to continue to be Russell 484169. I get to be Cassandra Hunneke, healthy in recovery, showing my obligation to the community, showing successful recovery, and having that as my give back to the community for my past wrongdoings and obligations to that. So I don't know where the fix is with that. But I know that it will work if the people apply themselves.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Hunneke.
Thank you.
Next we have in the room Grace Singh.
Hello, my name is Grace Singh, and I am Assistant to the President at Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. I'd like to thank you for allowing public testimony today, and I'd like to thank Senator Coghill for his legislation. The most persuasive myth distorting the view of criminal justice is that increasing arrests and imprisonment is an effective strategy for reducing crime. So thank you again, Senator Coghill. His staff, Jordan Schilling, Greg Razzo, and the Criminal Justice Reform Commission with their efforts to reduce recidivism in a meaningful way. That being said, there are some provisions within version P that are contrary to the intent of the bill and the commission. Regarding the suspended entry of judgment and requiring cases to remain in court view, just puts up more barriers for former inmates to gain employment and housing, and this significantly discourages self-sufficiency, and it puts them in a more desperate position, which will not discourage crime or recidivism rates. Another issue we have with the new version P is the requirement for drug testing for felons. Drug addiction is not only a criminal justice problem, it's a public health problem, and it's also a national epidemic. Central Council is a rural nonprofit service provider, and lots of our clients live in rural areas. So a big question we have would be, how would you drug test people living in rural areas of Alaska? We believe that this new provision goes against the cost savings intent of the bill, and it also discourages the ease of entry for former inmates trying to transition into a more productive lifestyle. Those are our concerns with the new version P. There are amendments that we very much appreciate. I'd like to thank the chair for allowing me to speak to this very important issue, and I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I haven't run into any of my constituents that don't think that somebody that's a drug felon, that it's an infringement to have a drug test, but I talk in different crowds sometimes. But next we have, let's see. Sorry, I'm going to scroll this. Karen Nelson, I know you've testified in the past, so please come forward.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Karen Nelson, and I am the director of Haven House Juno, which is a transitional home for women coming back to their community after incarceration. First, I want to say, with listening to Cassandra speak, I was actually in prison with her, and it's just very emotional to know, you know, to see people moving forward and being mentors and doing this thing, because as she mentioned, you know, having those opportunities available, people do not always take those opportunities, but the ones that want to take those opportunities, it's still such a battle. I've also been a victim of sexual assault and domestic violence throughout many years of my life prior to my incarceration. The men that violated me were not prosecuted. It was my fault. I went through that system, and they were able to manipulate in a way that then brought me down this road of more abuse, because that's kind of what happens in that state of mind when you don't have the resources. And so I was able to tune that out with drugs and alcohol, and which led me into my own incarceration and my two felony drug convictions. One of my convictions was also a hanging prosecution charge against the man that was abusing me, because he was in the same vicinity as I was and had a warrant, had a felony warrant. And I'm not making excuses for my charges. I'm just letting you know that one of the things that I've learned through the justice system is what a felon really looks like and how that really happens on the ground level. I've been a victim. I victimized my community. I'm a mother of three. Obviously, it wasn't a good mother I was using. But today, I'm an asset to our community. I'm an advocate for those who want to strive in their life to rise to the highest potential that they can. I'm the director of a home of house full of women who have also been traumatized, victimized, and want to do better. But because of their crimes, they have barriers to do that. These are all drug offenses. I'm not making light of that either, but the resources just aren't there. Even when we get out, and I'm trying to outsource the resources for these beautiful, worthy, precious Alaskans, I find barriers. I am also still discriminated with my criminal record, as well as being a woman in long-term recovery. What that means for me in recovery is that I haven't used a drink or drug since June 1st. That also means that I am able to be the mother that my children always deserve to have, that I am able to be the guide for others who want to have this journey of recovery, and also to really be a voice when there's policies being made that affect myself, my family, and the people I work with every day. So I am in support of SB 91, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, going to Fairbanks, we're down to the last three. We have Natasha Singh, attending the Chief's Conference.
Good morning. Thank you. This is Natasha Singh, General Counsel of Tanana Chiefs Conference. I can't thank this committee enough and Senator Coghill for the great work that has been done to reform the criminal justice system. TCC speaks for rural Alaska and the Alaska Native population in the interior. We are joined with Kowarik, Tlingit Haida, and Manilik in our support of criminal justice reform. Our sole mission as Native nonprofits is to seek wellness for our people. The largest barrier to Alaska Native wellness is the flawed criminal system in this state. I will not use the term justice system because there is nothing just about it. TCC supports Senate Bill 91 and its previous version, Version N, because it completely overhauls the system, something which is needed to reduce crimes and reduce the number of victims. Let me remind the committee that some of the highest rates of victims in the nation live in rural Alaska. We at TCC, Tlingit Haida, Kowarik, and Manilik, we speak for the victims. These are our mothers, sisters, family, and tribal members. We, let me repeat, are the victims of some of the highest crime rates in the nation. We know firsthand sending criminals away does not end their criminal behavior, but perpetuates it. Most of these offenders are addicts. They are not well. They are a public health problem and should be treated as such. With the facts in hand, knowing the longer an individual sits in jail, the increased likelihood they will repeat criminal behavior, knowing those in prison are mostly addicts, knowing in this generation criminal offenders have often been victims themselves, knowing Natives are arrested, prosecuted at higher rates, and serve longer sentences, knowing natives are disproportionately our victims in this state. The only conclusion we draw is that the current system seeks to criminalize Alaska Natives and seeks to make Alaska Natives victims. We ask and we plead that you support version N of Senate Bill 91. We absolutely need a complete overhaul in this system in order to heal our people, make this state safer, and end victims in rural Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have two calls from Arizona. Elizabeth Hazen.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Hazen, and I thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak. I'm speaking on behalf of myself and my husband, Richard Hazen. We've been residents of Alaska for over 40 years, and we care about the state and what goes on. I'd like to say that we are both in strong support of Senate Bill 91, all of its goals that it's designed to accomplish. We've reviewed SB 91 as well as we can. We're not lawyers, and we're not involved in any of the organizations that deal with this. But we feel that it's an important tool, both in reducing taxpayer costs and an effective way to reduce recidivism and to ease the burden of prison overcrowding. We just want to support the bill. We reviewed the recommendations of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. We find them to be sensible and just and practical for both public safety and for criminal rehabilitation and reentry into society as productive individuals. This is kind of what we feel is important is everybody that is an offender is an individual. We realize that the laws have to be written so that they treat everybody kind of the same, but the people are not the same. And they all have different circumstances. So what we'd really like to support is the changes to parole, which gives inmates an opportunity for discretionary parole. And we particularly think that this should be offered to current incarcerated inmates, that when the effective date is looked at for the parole provisions, that it should apply to those that are currently incarcerated as well as those awaiting sentencing that have either been charged or are in the process of being charged. We think that offering them the opportunity based on them as an individual to get discretionary parole is important. For one thing, if it gets them out of the system sooner, it saves money, and if they can become a productive member of society, then that's helping, and it's not being a drain on it's not being drained on society. We also support all the provisions and suggestions for more training for the and more support for the inmates while they are incarcerated that prepares them to come back out. And for those who are not like habitual criminals, give them the opportunity to prove that they can be a productive member of society again. Anyway, I'm not used to doing this, so but I do appreciate all the work that has been done on Senate Bill 91. We are in support of it. And we'd like to thank all of the members of the legislature who have worked on this. And I think that's what I have to say, so thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Hazen. Next up, also in Arizona, Trina McAnulty.
Hello, good morning. Senators and members of the committee, I appreciate also you giving me an opportunity to speak, and I am speaking in support also of Bill 91. I am part of the Supporting Our Loved Ones group, and I support Ms. Angela Hall's letter to the team. My husband, he is not really affected by this bill at all because he is, his crime is warranted as, well, that doesn't matter. He's, in 2012, he was granted parole for 2017, so he will be getting out soon. But my part of the hope for the future is definitely the treatment programs and making things not so much easier, but so that they don't go back, you know, having these programs. And the programs that they do have now in the systems, my husband is taking advantage of every single one of them, and they are very beneficial. So more programs and training and help is definitely needed. And so I do support the bill also, and I was just calling to give my testimony on that, and I appreciate you giving me that opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. McAnulty. That looks like we've completed everybody that signed in. So we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Unless there is anybody that had wished to speak and hasn't. Okay, we'll now officially close it. We'll just take a brief at ease. Thank the public that testified today. Final time. You have two other committees to testify in as well later. So we'll stand briefly at ease. Senate State Affairs, come back to order after the brief recess to reposition my staff, Mr. George, who will be assisting in the presentation of the amendments. First, if you can just do we'll go through the amendments first, and we'll talk about the fiscal notes afterwards. I'm going to start off by offering the amendments. Senator Huggins will object, so we get the content and the purpose on the record, and we'll dispense with votes if necessary. So, I move amendment number one.
No object.
Mr. George.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Daniel George, staff to Senator Stoltz. Before members is amendment number one. That's P.1 as well, if you're looking at the document identifier. And all these amendments are available to the public and have been released since yesterday. Amendment number one requires the Department of Corrections, within 30 days after sentencing of an offender, the providing to a victim of a crime information on the earliest dates the offender could be released on furlough, probation, or parole, including reductions for good time or other good conduct incentives, and the process for release, including contact information for the decision-making bodies. Amendment number one requires the court to provide the victim a form with information on who a victim may contact if they have questions about the sentence or release of an offender, the potential for release of the offender on furlough, probation, or parole for good time credit, and allows the victim to update their contact information with the court and the Department of Corrections. And this was brought to the committee by the Office of Victims Rights.
And it's noted as by Stoltz, it's by request, and I think the record should reflect it's by request. It reflects by request, reflects the input from the Office of Victims Rights, a branch within the legislative branch, and that is charged with implementing the provisions of our constitutional amendments. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I'm not going to object to the amendment. I guess the question that I'll probably follow along with this in is, it's the earliest date, but sometimes there are ranges, and there's, it depends, right? I mean, there's a, on some issues it would depend upon calculation of good time, things like that. So they would calculate to the maximum, I suppose, or to the minimum?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill. The court would provide the victim, if there is a victim that can be identified with this form, the information and how to update their contact information. The court does not do a lot of the calculations in these cases, and they informed us that this is sort of a two-part amendment, where within 30 days after sentencing, Department of Corrections, who actually does these calculations, would provide this to the victim, no earlier than type calculation.
My apologies. I probably should have highlighted that. The Department of Corrections then would have to give the earliest, which means it would be the absolute minimum based on no good time and all that, right?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, it would be the earliest possible release under the provisions, including the ones
so they
in
would
the
count the time. And those are the kind of things, there's calculations that would go into it probably, and that's why I'll just kind of watch how it goes, but I'm not going to object to it. I think it's a good concept of just how does it work, you know.
And Alaska currently has a truth in sentencing statute, which... Yeah. There's going to be a lot of variations in that and recalculations with assuming this bill passes. So it's going to be, it's probably even more important that that victims and the public. I can tell you I worked on the Truth in Sentencing Amendment back in 1997, the statute. And one of the cases that really was highlighted, there was a sex of child offender in Anchorage, and I remember the Channel 2 News reports that this individual would be an old, decrepit man by the time he was ever released to breathe public air, and a couple years later, through a series of these the machinations of the process, he was out, and well, that's the way the system worked, but the public was given the wrong impression that that person was getting the 68 years, and if it's not 68 years, the public deserves to know, and I think the public deserves to know what the real sentence is, and that's part of a. This is part of sunlight on the whole process as well, and maybe there'd be. But anyway, that's the intent. Is objection maintained?
I remove my objections.
Hearing no other objection, Amendment Number 1 is passed. I move Amendment Number 2.
Object,
Mr. George.
Daniel George, staff to Senator Stoltz. Amendment number 2, which is P.2, clarifies that the conditional repeal of the exemption from the ban on food stamps and temporary assistance for convicted drug felons is repealed if prior to 2027 a court has found the drug testing for state assistance requirement unconstitutional. There is a requirement that the reviser statutes check for this sort of thing, and they've started to set a sunset on when they will continue to look for that out 10 years. That's why the date 2027 appears. Essentially, if the drug testing is found to be unconstitutional, the exemption on that ban for this particular population would be repealed.
And for the record, there have the only message of unconstitutionality was delivered by a public assistance director. Department of Law has not contacted us, so... The message of that threat or whatever was delivered by a pretty low-level person on the food chain. So, and it certainly wasn't somebody from the Department of Law that has delivered that, and certainly no high levels of the Walker administration. So that is objection maintained?
I remove my objections.
Are there any other objections? Hearing none, Amendment Number 2 is passed. I move Amendment Number 3.
Object.
Mr. George.
Daniel George, staff to Senator Stoltz. Amendment number 3, or P.3, corrects a drafting error in Section 37 regarding what was item number 14 in the summary of changes. This limits a person to only one new bail hearing for new information relating to that person's inability to post the required bail. Now that a person's inability to post bail can be taken into account under Senate Bill 91. The court system has reviewed this amendment and verified that it accomplishes the committee's intent.
And Mr. George, they not only reviewed it, I believe there was collaboration.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Is that probably more accurate? Is objection maintained?
Remove my objections.
Is there any other objection to amendment number 3? Hearing none, amendment number 3 is adopted. I move amendment number 4.
Object.
Mr. George.
Amendment number 4, P.4, deletes the requirement under Section 73 that convictions for violation of condition of release appear on court view. The committee was concerned that these convictions may not appear on court view now that violation of conditions of release is reduced from a crime to an offense under Senate Bill 91 version, well, all versions at this point. The court system has assured the chair's office that these offenses will show on court view, even if they are just an offense. So this requirement is unnecessary in Senate Bill 91 and adds unnecessary confusion. As a note, the requirement that suspended entry of judgment appear on court view in Section 73 remains.
Is objection maintained?
Yeah, remove my objections.
Are there any other objections? Hearing none, amendment number 4 is adopted. I move amendment number 5.
Object.
Mr. George.
Amendment number 5, P.5, removes from Section 61 the requirement that the court shall send a copy of the probation officer's motion that probation be terminated to the Department of Corrections sufficiently in advance of any scheduled hearing to enable the Department of Corrections to notify the victim of that crime. Courts brought this to our attention. They believe this is perhaps redundant or unnecessary at the least. As the probation officer is already a member of the Department of Corrections, it would be unnecessary for them to give to the court something which the court would then be required to give back to corrections. Corrections can simply notify the victim themselves.
Is objection maintained?
Remove my objections.
Are there any other questions or objections? None. Amendment number 5 is adopted. I move amendment number 6.
Object.
Mr. George.
Daniel George, staff to Senator Stoltz. Amendment number 6, P.6, clarifies, and this was brought to the committee's attention at the previous hearing by the Department of Health and Social Services. This clarifies that in addition to a person who tests positive for the illegal use of controlled substances, a person who refuses to submit to a test required under Section 134 is disqualified from receiving public assistance for 6 months, just like someone who had failed a drug test.
And this amendment arose from the discussion brought up by one of the administration officials' testimony that, about the refusal that the drug test is consistent with other sections of statute.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Is objection maintained?
I remove my objections.
Are there any other questions or objections? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just a point. And I know this bill's going to judiciary next, and we'll get some analysis on the legality of this and the constitutionality. And I know Senator Coghill had an opinion that questioned some of this. I just read it briefly, and it questioned it on two grounds, or several grounds, right? The privacy, search and seizure provisions of the Constitution, and also the single subject rule. So I'm sure we'll have a much more detailed analysis of that in the next committee.
Well, maybe the administration will come out a little more forcefully and give me something to talk about as well if they don't believe that somebody has a drug conviction and wants to get a pretty substantial benefit should have to show that they're not spending that money on something else. But I'll have this discussion, not just in this building, on this one. I think it's a pretty important issue. Is objection maintained?
No.
Nope.
Objection's removed.
So with that, amendment number 6 is adopted. I don't have any other amendments. Are there other amendments?
Mr. Chairman, the committee has not been provided with any other amendments.
Okay. We will put on the record that there was an acknowledgement of the judiciary chair for looking at the amendments proposed by the Moore family, and there seemed to be a receptivity. That will certainly be up to the next committee, and I hope that's an issue discussed. There's one other amendment I'd about involvement in the process for the correction officers to be involved in. I've had a continuing discussion with Commissioner Williams. We want to make sure we get it right. There's a he's expressed a commitment to continue to work on that in the next committee to use the expertise and knowledge of the correction officers in reviewing the releases of inmates in an advisory in a meaningful advisory fashion. And Commissioner Williams will be up to talk about the overall bill in a moment. You want to, we had the fiscal note issues, you know, a discussion, I guess, primarily. A lot of those have just come in the evening. So,
to the chair, Senator Stoltz, matter of housekeeping, members will have before them the public testimony received through today since last hearing. There are 10 additional letters, including several from testifiers today. We have received and posted more than 70 letters to the committee on basis and provided them to members. As to the fiscal notes, members have before them a spreadsheet to simplify. Since there have been three versions of this bill before the committee, and a fourth presumably when this bill is sent forth from committee, there have been 31 fiscal notes to date across those three versions. It is anticipated that 15 of these fiscal notes will apply to the version that passes out of committee, and those are listed in the far right column along with the component number and date of the fiscal note. A fiscal note packet has been provided to members and the public. There is one loose item, Judicial Council fiscal note came in this morning, so there should be a total of 15 fiscal notes. I believe we may have someone from the Division of Legislative Finance as well as several members from administrative divisions and departments to speak to their notes individually.
I'd like, is Ms. Cunningham still here? Can you join us just for a couple of minutes, and why don't you stay up there, Mr. George, and just give us just a general overview. We're not trying to be the finance committee here, but we would provide, I'd like you to provide some of your division's commentary on the fiscal notes and the construct and so forth.
Okay. For the record, my name is Kelly Cunningham. I work for the Division of Legislative Finance. I was more prepared to answer a question, Mr. Chairman.
We're not that easy here.
Oh, okay. My initial,
be very general. It can be very general.
Okay. My my initial thoughts, our initial pass at the fiscal notes, first of all, we just received most of the health and social service ones yesterday. I haven't had an opportunity to look at them thoroughly. The only one that has hard numbers on it is the Department of Corrections. And I've talked to the department. I think they've worked with the Pew Charitable Trust, who has provided some assumptions. The department has provided their numbers, and I think, you know, the math adds up on the potential savings combined with the costs. I think it's rather speculative at this point. Like I said, the other departments, they none of them have any costs in FY17, so I've been more focused on the Department of Corrections fiscal note.
Is it usual to have such a reliance on a think tank providing financial data? Don't we usually have OMB and other entities doing that?
I have not experienced this type of a collaboration before, but I know I have talked to the department, and a lot of it is their calculation, but they have had to use the assumptions from the Pew Trust to come up with the final numbers.
So an advocate is providing the fiscal analysis?
That is, yes, that is my understanding.
Okay. I just wanted to put that on the record, the speculative nature, and it's this is going to be a moving target, and we're not trying to substitute the Finance Committee, but I think one of the, certainly not Senator Coghill has much more refined motives, but one of the motives of the bill is to save money, and that will certainly be for the Finance Committee to ferret that out. They have the last voice on that. Did you have any comments, Senator?
Just comment on it. And I'm grateful for the Pew Charitable Trust to do some number crunching, but I don't know that they're necessarily the primary advocate, because we got a letter from both House and Senate leadership that asked to look at three different scenarios of cost savings. And so I think there was some downward pressure on the administration as well to try to figure out, okay, if this happened, what would our cost savings be? If we put in place these pretrial services, what would that cost? So I think there was some downward pressure from both the governor and the leadership of both bodies to come in with some scenarios. So I think this is unusual in many, many ways, but I don't know that I'd put it totally on the Pew Charitable Trust.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I agree with you. I didn't intend to put it solely on the
Pew. I think I was leading the witness.
And I would also like to add that the Pew Charitable Trust was invited by all three branches of government, so, but they are in charge of the model that provides the assumptions. Thank you.
With that, do we have any other comments on the fiscal note? Or any other comments, Mr. George?
I think that's something that's, of course, I'm stepping forward before the committee, taking a risk here and putting this out there, but Daniel George, Staff Senator Stoltz, I think Ms. Cunningham has expressed to our office in reviewing the fiscal notes that it's clear that the math makes sense when you look at the number of inmates who are proposed to be reduced multiplied by the daily rate of the cost of the inmates. That math makes sense in the fiscal notes. I think what the big question mark going forward and that the Finance Committee will have to examine is how they get to those numbers. I think in the first fiscal note, next year the reduction was 1,500 inmates. That's an awful big round number. And I don't believe that the Division of Legislative Finance has been provided with the analysis that gets them to that number. So the math works, but where those inputs come from, I think, is the question.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Certainly, in the first committee referral, they're scrambling because we've given them amendments just days to look at. So my expectation is by the time we get up to Finance Committee, those will be refined.
Yeah, we're just leaving a blood trail right now. So. No, not an intended ugly metaphor.
Coghill blood?
Hopefully not victim's blood, that's for sure. That's as I define victims. I think as the Constitution does. Thank both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to, invite both, we have Commissioner Folger's deputy, Mr. Comer, and Commissioner Williams. Just for efficiency, why don't you both have our two of our Administration of Justice folks up here. And why don't we swing a third chair up here for Mr. Skidmore, Chief Deputy for Criminal. That's not too constrained, but this will help us out and meet our time constraint here to have you all up here. And going to introduce all yourselves for the record, and you can decide who amongst the three of you wants to lead off and just provide any general comments and maybe elicit questions where we're at right now.
Good morning. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law.
Good morning. I'm Bill Comer, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety.
And I'm Dean Williams, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Corrections.
We can just call you Commissioner. I hate that designee, but it's not meant to cripple your credibility. You're a Commissioner.
I'll just start by giving very brief overview comments. We know this is a process. We know that everyone's been working hard to try to fine-tune this. We're continuing to work with, we know there's other committees this is going to. We're overall supportive of the bill. We know that as changes made, there's going to be some tweaking of that, and we realize that's part of the process. And so on we go, and I have no big observations in terms of the amendments that have been made. We're going to work with whatever comes out of the end process. This is all good work.
I just want to, just while you're here, Commissioner, the issue, just to put on the record now that my judiciary chairman showed up, the issue of having some role for the Department of Correction staff to play, for them to have a meaningful advisory role, just to put on the record that your commitment to continue to work on that, and I trust, I know you have a good relationship with the employees as well, and have them have a meaningful role, and I think they I think it will really benefit the public to have folks that are the most familiar with these inmates. So with that acknowledged.
Well, yeah.
No, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, and through the Chair, Senator McGuire, I'm totally for this idea. I've only been concerned about trying to offer friendly amendments to the committee about what that might look like without, you know, tying up the works, as it were. And so conceptually, I love the idea, and we should be providing the people that are working directly with inmates, providing input and about and feedback to the parole board and probation about the conduct of inmates. It's absolutely the right thing to do, and so I'm telling you on the record, I'm for it, and I just didn't want to gum up anything here in terms of...
If it was easy, I would have drafted the... I wanted to make sure...
Anyhow, no, I'm totally with you. It's a great idea, and I'm for it, and I'll work with Senator McGuire if, in fact, there's something we want to do statutorily. I can tell you, policy-wise, we can do a lot of these things. I know that doesn't memorialize it longer than purview, under my purview, but certainly it's the right thing to do. It's right headed.
I'd like to recognize it in the statute. I think it'll allow us to utilize a very effective tool for folks that know, for bad or worse. I'm just not looking the converse of the opposite, the negative part. They know who some of the bad actors are. They also know some of the folks that probably were ready to be released very earlier in their term, and as they know, they're in the wrong place for the folks that are on the ground there. So appreciate that. I know Senator McGuire probably shares a lot of those same views. So look forward to that developing over there in the next committee. Mr. Comer, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. The department is, to echo Commissioner, very supportive of the process, been very engaged with Senator Coghill's staff on working on the concerns that law enforcement have brought forward. I don't probably need to repeat those. I think it's a process, and we feel like those issues are being addressed, and very supportive of the process. The public discussion about criminal justice reform and victims' rights is a difficult discussion to have, but one that needs to happen, and we appreciate being involved in that.
And Mr. Skidmore.
So John Skidmore from the Department of Law. I would again echo both what Commissioner Williams and Deputy Commissioner Comer said. The Department of Law is in agreement that there are changes that can be made in the criminal justice system. We certainly participated in the Criminal Justice Commission, and we continue to work with Senator Coghill's office closely and expect to do so throughout the process. I don't know if you want us to be addressing just fiscal notes or sort of general things, but overall, we're going to continue to work with everyone in the process and the stakeholders to try and make sure that we get to the right outcome for all Alaskans.
Well, all three of you guys, particularly, we're going to have to figure out how to release the right prisoners without releasing another geriactive, and that is probably the pall that's hanging over this. This whole bill and this whole concept is for all the good, or a fairer, smarter system. There are going to be people that are going to be released that are a danger. You can't release that many people and not have that be the case. And how to figure that out and do the balance and trade-offs. And that's why I remain very skeptical of the process. I appreciate especially the Department of Law, the amount of work you've provided. I hope you didn't get slapped too much for your candor, but Mr. Skidmore, but it was a valuable part of the process. Any other questions for the three representatives of the Administration of Justice agencies? Thank you all, and forward to your work when after this departs this committee. Any other valedictory? It's been a great friend to have here, but I'm really, really glad to push it out. It feels like it wasn't the 18th, but I got like an Obamacare extension. This teenager was 26 before I wasn't responsible for it. Well, I've put my some of my concerns on the record, and I'm gonna. I know there will be attempts to change some of the things I think were positive, but that's process. I've made my best efforts here in the committee and tried to work with the sponsor, and have not tried. We have worked, and a lot of these amendments, I think these amendments were ones that were vetted through the sponsor's office, and I would have made a lot more, but it still had to be John Coghill's bill at the end, so I wasn't able to make all the changes I wanted. So with that balance, there's a lot of other amendments I would have liked to have made, but it still has to be your bill, recognizable. So that's the challenge I had. So I, and this is certainly just one of three committees, so we took our best shots. There's still some issues out there, but it's bicameral process and onward, and I'm glad you'll get to work on it somewhere else as much as I've loved this process. It is. I truly appreciate that I got to be involved on this, and I hope you. Well, thank you for your patience. As I was the probably the your biggest skeptic in the building, but hopefully a constructive skeptic. Senator Coghill, any comments you want to make before you make the motion?
Sure. Well, it is a process, and it's not just my bill. The Criminal Justice Commission worked together. The legislature has been involved both in the House and Senate on recidivism. The recidivism problem is this. If we are recidivating more, that means more crime. If we're recidivating less, that means less crime. That's just the facts. And so we've got to figure out a way to turn that recidivism around. And that's kind of what the aim of this is, looking broadly at the criminal justice system. The reason we had a commission is because we knew that if we tried to do it all in one committee, it would be done one section at a time over a decade or more. So this is an omnibus bill. It's a big deal. And for that,
omnibus or ominous?
The chairman and I might have a very different view on that. What we did in this was really there's a cornerstone issue here, and that is the public safety and the victims' rights. There are several constitutional issues that we have to balance in here. The right to privacy, as has been brought up, the right of holding people in corrections facilities, treating them as human beings with the deepest respect we can, the right to speak, the right to associate, the right of victims. All those things are balanced in here in so many ways. The right to due process, the right to a fair trial, quick and speedy trial, the right to have somebody be held accountable properly but not necessarily wearied by their own government. So there's all those things that we're trying to balance in here. In the meanwhile, those of us who go on in our day who never engage the legal system, which we want to be a justice system, we want to be free from fear as much as possibly can, and that is those who will steal for drug problems or kill because of anger or just people who have mental illnesses that need to be probably brought to an accountability in a very, very different way. So all of those things are kind of being brought up as we speak to this. So we wanted evidence-based as much as we could, and as much as the chairman doesn't like the Pew Charitable Trust, it was them or CSG. Both of those had offered to help. And, you know, if I'd have known there was going to be such a problem here, I might have pushed harder for CSG. But they both offered really kind of the same, and in comparison, they came up with many of the same conclusions. So I'm not a big fan of some of the liberal things the Pew Charitable Trust does. But they tried to get us evidence-based practices from whatever's going on all over the United States, which they did, and the commission got to consider them. We tried to focus the prison beds on serious violent offenders. Some of the amendments we did here in this committee brought that to a higher level, which I think is probably appropriate, because most of what we want to deal with is misdemeanors, because those are the ones that are filling our jails right now, and those are the ones that are recidivating at a very, very high rate. So we tried to look at getting people to, for example, on the violent side, those who are ordered to sex offender treatment, are getting it outside of jail when they should be getting it inside jail before they go out. The only way we're going to do that is if we take that reinvestment. So there's talk about the reinvestment part. The substance abuse sexual assault treatment should happen in jail before they even get out. There should be a follow-up. There should be those who do programs afterwards. And I think if we can save money by holding those who are the misdemeanants accountable and invest some of the money in, for example, those victims advocate program like the Green Dot program or some other treatment services that are more appropriate. And so the risk assessment tool is very important to invest in so that we know that we're getting the right people to the right programs. In the pretrial area, probably for the first time we're talking about a risk assessment based on will they show up and are they more dangerous to the public. Right now it's just based on do you have money. And so I think right now we're trying to figure out ways to do that. So the reinvestment part is on prevention, violence prevention, on victim services like the Green Dot, treatment services that are going to be related to the need. And then there's hopefully money that we can get into reentry services. But I didn't want people to think that the reinvestment part has been lost on us because it starts with pretrial. It's in the jails by way of programs, and it's by way of post-conviction, whether it's the way we do probation, parole, or the way we do service requirements. So I think there's lots to do. I mean, you're touching almost every area of law in this particular area. So I'm trying to be patient because I know I'm not the expert on this. I also know that there are very, very different many advocates. I know that in the Judiciary Committee, we're going to deal with some of the criminal elements that need to be looked at. The Criminal Justice Commission looked at it at a very high level and gave very broad recommendations. We're staying very, very close to those recommendations, probably on some of the arrest issues, the violations. We pushed back a little bit on that, and that was totally appropriate. So many of the things we did in this committee, I think, are valuable. It's the 45th day of the legislature, so you know, I'm feeling a little under pressure time-wise, but I think it's important for us to take the time in committee to look at them, and I expect the next two committees will do that. The House is going to start the same process. They're starting fairly close to where we're at, I understand, and so with that, I look forward to it. And what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if at all possible, I'd like to make a motion to move Senate Bill 91 version P from the committee with individual recommendations and the attached volume of fiscal notes.
There is objection, Senator.
Objection for conversation. I'm burdened by the first young lady that spoke, and Senator Coghill said you'd be willing to talk to her. I think all of us would like to make sure that what we're doing is not just that she knows what we're doing. It's not her perception differently. So I guess said another way, what does the bill say versus what she thought we were doing and it swinging the door open?
You want me to answer?
Yeah, please.
Well, there were several things. For example, the release or probation of violent sexual offenders. It's just not the way she was describing it. They will be held accountable. They don't get that early release. I think one of the actual amendments we took in here even ramped that up a little bit more. The idea of there was probably four or five things in there. For example, the ability to pay charge on the pretrial. Under the pretrial, it's a risk assessment based, not the ability to pay. The ability to pay is one of the triggers. But I think she was under the impression that this person, a violent crime, could get right up. Right now, they can do that. All they got to do is put up some money. But under the way we're proposing it here, it would be on the risk to the society, the risk danger. So I think there are several things that she misunderstood. That's why I didn't want to, you know, when somebody is in the journey that she's in, God forbid that any of us would have to go through that. I am so broken-hearted for people that have to do that. We don't want to make that more painful as we go through here. But even the fact of a plea agreement is so painful. Some of it is because of she, like she said, she just wanted to get away from it. I just take care of them. I understand that. But we have not dealt with the violent crimes to the level that we have with the misdemeanors. The only thing that I probably will look at again, and I think the chairman's brought it up a number of times, and that is on early release. So we took the sexual assault people out of that, the violent crime people out of that early release provision. But I think there's still some work to do in there. And so I think Judiciary Committee, we should continue to look at it. And then what Butch Moore brought up, I think, is a legitimate point. If we have such a disparate sentencing, but to be fair, the sexual assault has a range that is very, very different. And the way they actually formulate the law, we actually have a range on one that, and he's talking about the high range on one and low range on the other, I think. So we need to look at that. But I told him that my commitment was to look at it. But they're very different approaches. But he's exactly right. One penalty does not match the other in as far as the greatness of the crime. I get that. I don't know that was the focus of the Criminal Justice Commission, nor was it mine, to start looking at those, except for we were just saying once a person's been in jail for so long, the diminishing value starts to show up. So hence you saw the geriatric. But there was a look back so that people would get a chance to make their case before the parole board. The parole board still gets to make the decision, and I think the chairman's exactly right. The corrections officer should be in on that discussion. So there's a whole range of things yet that we want to make sure that they actually work to keep people safe, hold people accountable. But then if a life has redemptive value, that they actually get to find a pathway to it.
Yeah, thank you, and I remove my objections.
There's Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and so I guess technically I'd be making an objection to speak as well. But to be removed. I just want to say on the record for people who are here in the room, Diane Bloomer, who's there in the back, if she'd just wave her hand, she is my committee aide for, our committee aide for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and she is a former Commissioner of Labor under Governor Sean Parnell, and we're delighted to have her on the Senate team because she spent a lot of her work on prisoner reentry, specifically in the area of putting those who've gone down a bad path back on the track to become worthwhile again in society. And so in our committee, I just wanted you to know that's your point of contact for those of you here in the room. I've written down, you know, throughout the hearings, the areas that we'll be focusing on, but the tension between victims' rights and the need to punish those who have committed serious offenses against Alaskans, including the area of good time and early release, the notion of risk assessment and which categories are qualified. We want to bring more law enforcement officials in for more of a roundtable discussion to hear their views and have them fully vetted, the COs, the POs, APD officers, troopers, et cetera, to find out places where they feel there are gaps in this bill, where they might be more useful, their knowledge as a part of this process. The Department of Law and John Skidmore has raised some issues. I think we'd like to continue that conversation with the Department of Law on the corrections pieces. Thank you to Commissioner Williams. And I think, you know, one of the things I want to say on the record, when you're brought in to do an investigation, often the perception can be that you are so far this way, but that's because you're having you're coming in at the ground level to upend and root out a lot of problems. And I think fair conversations you and I have had is that certainly the COs and POs need to be involved in the process too, and you're willing and would like them to be at the table. So in our committee, it'd be nice to bring them up and also a little bit of a round table and see where that balance is. And then finally, I've written the treatment piece, and this is the last point I want to make, dovetailing on to Senator Coghill. You know, I think one of the biggest frustrations I've had in my 16 years here is the inability to meaningfully improve our system of justice. It's been piecemeal. We've all been a part of omnibus crime bills, victims' rights bills, et cetera, but really, when you sit here in 2016, whether it's the Pew Foundation or CSG or whoever's looking at it, you know, Mr. Coons is right. It's broken. I mean, our system is fundamentally broken in that we have a recidivism rate in almost every category that exceeds the national average. Of every type of criminal, women recidivate more in the state of Alaska. I think it's 9 times that of women in the lower 48. All of the ages, typically your risk category, your risk profile is men between the ages of 16 and 40, and that's kind of your hot spot, and yet in Alaska you see it coming younger and you see it going older, you see it migrating into women. And so what we know is that we're spending $54,000 a year approximately per prisoner that is put behind bars. That's, you know, some people have used the analogy of an Ivy League education. That's a good one to think about. Most Alaskan children don't get that opportunity. What are we getting for it? We're getting exceptionally high recidivism rates, and we're getting people that are coming out more broken in many cases than when they went in, Butch Moore's point. So I think there's no question but that we have to continue to look at this issue, and I do think it's concentric circles. You start with the most serious of offender, and you say they're locked up for life, and sorry, and that's unfortunate. You didn't choose your parents or your life circumstances, but you're in that nucleus. As you move out and you risk assess, what you're trying to do is catch the guys on the outside, the guys and the gals, who have a broken trail that they're blazing, and you want to get them back on track through workforce development issues, through reentry support, housing, et cetera, and substance abuse and mental health treatment, and get them on the right path. If we can do that in small measure with Senate Bill 91, I think that's great. And then John and I had a great conversation, Senator Coghill and I, that as we move through this in judiciary, I want to create a binder for all these sections that you all who are here in the coming 15 years can look at for institutional reference points and come back and revisit this. You know, did we go too far in this area of good time risk assessment release, early release? Did we miss a category? The obvious one today was pointed out by Butch Moore, and we all saw it glaringly. Why on earth would you have a murderer you know, in a position of having a lower risk assessment and coming out with good time ahead of someone who may have been a first-time sex offender? It doesn't make sense. But are we missing other categories there? This idea of ankle monitoring and the 24/7 sobriety program, we're seeing results, but you also heard the APD officer say, we don't feel ankle monitoring really fundamentally works for the hardened criminal. They don't communicate with us. We don't have a method of knowing where they are, and then you end up with the point warns off situation. So how to measure those results, and then, of course, corrections being the huge elephant in the room just because of the cost. I mean, we're on track right now to build another Goose Creek. Nobody here in this room wants to make that vote. There are schools out there falling apart that we could be fixing, quite frankly. And so how do we divert some of those folks that are on track to go there in a way that doesn't threaten public safety and doesn't leave a young woman like the young woman that testified here today feeling like she had lived through, Emily Hayes was her name, like she had lived through one of the most horrific things in her life, and then on top of it that the Senate was somehow not regarding that as a serious fact, and we do. So I just say thank you, Mr. Chairman, for all your work, and we will take it up in the Judiciary Committee. Senator Wilkowski is also on the committee, so you can expect all the institutional knowledge from this committee to move forward.
Thanks. Before Senator Coghill makes a motion, I would like to thank the spokespeople for victims that were very instrumental in this bill, both through Taylor Winston, who spoke for a lot of silent victims through her advocacy of victims. Many of them, who understandably prefer to remain anonymous, they've and the Moore family, who have turned a tragedy into something positive. And I can't say enough about the courage of Ms. Haynes. I don't know if, I certainly wouldn't have the courage to come before and testify about something, and want her voice to be continue to be heard. That's the aspect of victims. I think we've made a beachhead on this, and I hope we we maintain all that hard-fought sand and beach that we've protected for victims. So,
Senator Coghill, the motion?
The motion needs to be amended because...
Just make a new motion.
The new motion would be a move that we move Senate Bill 91, Version P, from committee as amended with the individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? With that, the bill's moved out of committee, and we have no need for an afternoon meeting, which is going to break everybody's heart. With that, thank you.
Yeah.
With that, we stand in adjournment.